I know. I'm changed. I'm not wearing the same clothes I was wearing before because I'm getting ready to go on stage, and we don't mess around. You know that.
The spirit of James Brown is in the house.
If you see Kiluanji, wake up.
Kiluanji's at the bar.
Okay. He's making a new project already.
That's right.
So I would like
setting
to...
setting myth free on the unexpected.
Yeah. I would like to open the floor. We have some, a few, 10, 15 minutes to continue this conversation. Also among us, if we have questions to inside of the group.
Yeah, Greg, where did Don pass? I have a Don Cherry story because it's around 90. Around he passed in 95, so I would say around 94, when I was still living in Paris. Ramucho Mata, who did Brown Rice, invited me to be on an album with Don Cherry, and Don was pretty out there, and you know we met. It didn't happen, but you know, he was an amazing brother. But it was really great to meet him as well. So where did he pass? Did he pass in Europe?
At Nana's home, his daughter's home in Malaga, Spain.
Okay.
And when I was following your earlier writings, it was very interesting how Don Cherry became unclassifiable. So it was no category to. Somehow archive this jazz musician from the Afro-American scene in this new ethno music or world music, as you say. So he passed through many categories, like world music, but also he was considered pioneer of multiculturalism at the end of the 90s.
Well, I think the thing is that even though jazz has been conservatively recodified as almost like a monocultural music, it's always been something else, as Satch mentioned when he talked about all these streams that came together in New Orleans. So the music has always been global because of the triangular trade, you know, as they call it, you know, because of the slave trade and all the different cultures that coalesced there in the forming of New Orleans, you know, which in many ways was a city, a culture created from the swamp up by successive colonialist regimes, you know, and it also had this deep relationship with Cuba that's ongoing in terms of the trumpet tradition, you know. So, but I think of Don as someone who allowed many musical forms and cultures and spirits to inhabit his body, you know. He was in one sense, like I think he was he became indivisible in that sense, you know, because everything that he assimilated in terms of different musical traditions, he learned either from the source or doing a lot of research, you know, with what was available to him. If we speak of the, you know, the gamelan tradition, you know. But I think he becomes like this this avatar of what jazz really means and what it really derives from, you know.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, he was definitely a shapeshifter, and you know, there's no doubt about that. But he was also a spiritual shapeshifter because, as you see from the photos as well, he was embracing many different mythologies, cosmologies, and belief systems. And of course, those also come with synecdoches. So I think that was also very much part of what he was actually mining throughout his life.
One time he came back to Sweden after traveling for a long time in Africa. A curious Swedish journalist asked him, well, tell us something about, what did you learn about African wisdom? Traveling for all these 6 months, you've been going through caves and walking and just being a wanderer. And he said, well, the essence, what I really learned about Africa, it's always better to laugh than cry.
I'd like to ask you a question, Greg. Did he have a relationship with Ted Jones?
I'm not sure, but you know, when he talked about when the Ornette Coleman Quartet came to New York in 59 and kind of exploded, even the greatest jazz musician's conception of what the music could be, he said their biggest supporters were painters and poets. Okay. Yeah. So
I'm assuming that everybody knows who Ted Jones is.
Are you going to introduce?
No, let Greg introduce Ted.
Well, there were, when you talk about this thing called the Beat Poets, there were three poets, black poets, who were part of that history and that production. There's Leroy Jones, became Amiri Baraka, who you know. There's also Bob Kaufman, who was an amazing progenitor of that form. And then it was Ted Jones, who was also part of that world of the, you know, the Lower East Side. And it's interesting because it's a story that outside of the biography of Hetty Jones, who Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka, was married to, doesn't really acknowledge the impact that these black literary figures had, you know, and painters. Bob Thompson, you know, we can talk about. But they were very much a part of this so-called Beat Generation moment.
Please.
Hi, greetings. Thanks for the wonderful presentation, Sach. Congratulations for your project. I have a question, and it's very interesting that you focus on the Congo-Angola cultural heritage legacy when you cover the triangular journey between Africa, Europe and America, where these days, for some reasons, the focus is on the Yoruba, Santeria, Candomblé heritage. You go to Cuba, we know that there is a strong Palo Monte. You go to Brazil, there is a strong Congo heritage. But why is it, how can you explain, you have traveled, have done research, that for some reasons, the focus is more on, you know, the Yoruba West African heritage, whereas, you know, the Congo Angola, although we know it's present, but, you know, there aren't that many research, maybe with the exception of Robert Thompson, but it's not really overwhelming present. You know, we know we have the Bata and all that, but if you go to Brazil, we have the Quita, these instruments. But why is it that, you know, these days the focus is more on that West Africa, predominantly Yoruba, there were many influx, you know, of cultural legacies from Africa, but why is it that Congo, the Central Africa cultural legacy isn't really overt, where we know it's present, but so far, even the scholars, not many has really managed to dig that.
Well, I'm gonna have to kind of like disagree with you. Sorry, but especially Bob Thompson, who is a priest, he's an Nganga, has done a lot. And I mean, I mentioned earlier on about the book that he did that he spent a lot of research on about the love history of the tango, you know, where that is very specifically Congo. So there's been a lot of research on the Congo, but not so much about Angola, I think. There is one woman, what's her name? Do you know Jabir?
Marison.
She's done a lot of work, but I think in regards to the kind of sonic research that I've done. Exactly. Yeah, and so and I don't know. I've always been very, very, very attracted to Angola. I've been very, very attracted to the Chokwe, the Ovimbundu, the Holo. You know, all of these cultures that from spending quite a lot of time in Portugal and having a lot of Angolan friends, became somewhat familiar with that culture, and especially with the Sonics. There's like just amazing. Their Kisanji culture, the kalimba, and the rhythms that they used were amazing. And then from my relationship with Lisbon, and then really delving deep and deep and deeper into that part of the Congo, because as you know, it was the Congo. You know, I mean, it's the Congo Conference that created that border. You know. So yeah, here in Berlin, that's what it's called, the Congo Conference. Everybody here knows what the Congo Conference is. So yeah, my focus was on that. So many people have done research on Ghanaian and Nigerian music. That definitely will be included in one of my next Afrosonic mapping journeys. But yeah, I think it was very important to for me. Anyway, it was personally important for me to actually investigate and mine that Lusophone triangle.
My sister, I am curious about the musical culture of young Nubians today. Yes. And their relationship to the legacy of Hamza Eldin.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are three. There's on the Sudanese side of the Nuba, because obviously with the displacement, now you have the Egyptian Nubia and the Sudanese Nubia, and there's a young lady called Sara and the Nubatones, who's absolutely amazing, and to my knowledge, she's the only one who sings in Nubian today, and it's like really funky and it's amazing. Almost put her in, but anyway.
You showed me some recordings.
Yes, I showed you some recordings. Yeah. So there. It's what's interesting is that starting 2011, there has been, after the uprisings in Egypt and all of that, there has been a conscious effort made to learn the language, which is obviously very difficult since it's not written, but the few who do speak are now singing in Nubian. I just want to say something interesting. When I was recording this last bit, as we were sitting there, they were singing in Nubian, three policemen came and sat with us, and they immediately shifted into Arabic. And it was really interesting. It wasn't until later, it's like, what happened there? He says, you know, let's not start any problems. So it hasn't gone away.
Yeah, I think the Afrosonic mapping by such is somehow unfolding unconventional cartographies. The title of his talk was The Migration of the Eternal Afrosonic Signifier, so it's also ongoing. When we were drafting what could be the plan of the future project, in fact, Sach developed three more other possible Afrosonic mappings that have a lot of potential to do other counter cartographies. And in the case of Yihan, it's not a transnational migration of the Afrosonic signifier, but how somehow imploded inside of a nation of Egypt. So we wanted to do this different modus of cartographies to depict and map out how Sach would precisely tell with his method and his work these unconventional cartographies. So there is a question.
Hi, thank you for those wonderful talks, and also Kilwanji's, who is not here. Can I ask if the new Afrosonic cartographies can include the Indian Ocean, and how would you go about that?
Thanks. Well, they could include, but my focus is on, my focus is specifically on African musics. I do know that, but that's not where I'm going. You know, first the next Afrosonic mapping that I will most probably do will be looking at the Francophone, triangle, and definitely the British triangle, which would then include, of course, Nigeria, Cuba, Jamaica, and maybe up into the UK, because you know having Jamaican roots, that obviously is a very, very personal interest of mine, and then the Francophone one and the Belgian one, and then maybe afterwards we could meet and you could teach me something. Yeah. All right, cool. Or even before.
No, it's true, it's contagious. Even in my own country, now you have very big flows of recent migration from Colombia, from Venezuela, and from Haiti. So I was wondering all the time in another possible cartography that would lead such also until the Pacific, crossing beyond the very well-known unit of the Black Atlantic that we know by Paul Gilroy.
Well, you know, as I mentioned before in my talk about Colombia, you know, in regards to African sonics, one is absolutely obliged to mine those communities in Central and South America. I mean, there's so much knowledge there, you know, stuff that just doesn't exist on the continent. So yeah, I'm totally open to that. Yeah.
Would you put something like in Belize? There's the Garifuna,
yeah,
and the people like Andy Palacio and things like that. Would that be part of the
totally.
Same?
Yeah, it would. It would. You know, I mean, I haven't, you know, seriously thought out the next Afrosonic mapping. I'm sort of like getting out of this one and, you know, moving into the next. It's been 3 years. It's been a lot of work, and I still haven't finished. I got to go on stage in like 10 minutes. Yes.
So we will give such a break, and we will all meet together shortly after 9 in front of the bar to the concert of the Afrosonic mapping. Thank you, Jehan, Sach, Greg, and Kinuanji that is there.